You are listening to the, I mean, I guess it's the Punk News Podcast. John, is this still the Punk News Podcast?
No, no, we change it to now the Nikon, General Electric, Ford, Hyundai podcast brought to you by Spencer's.
Oh, okay. Well, it's that episode. I'm not sure. Here we go. This show is right now. I'm Adam White. I'm recording in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Regardless of the official status of this show, and John, I guess we should talk about that. I've been around for the past few weeks, so I don't really have any idea what you're doing. I know you are dutifully and like relentlessly recording things against all caution and better judgment. So I'm kind of stumbling around in the dark here. So, and I'm sure the listeners are at this point. They don't know what's going on. So should we address whatever?
I don't know what you're getting at, Adam. Are you quitting the show? Is that what this is about?
I don't know. I don't know where we are. No, okay. So just to fill people in. We recorded the Punkins Podcast episode 500, which was a big, massive 5-hour beast of a podcast that I do believe people will have in their feeds by the time they hear us, John, about it here. So we recorded that episode, and then immediately after that episode, I had all sorts of real-world chaos descend upon me, which went on for like 2 or 3 weeks. And John kept recording over my smoking corpse, but that was okay because, you know, the show must go on. Now, the plan was, and I guess kind of is that we had all sorts of retooling plans for after 500, but the chaos of the life of Adam White has delayed the actual rollout of that stuff, and I don't really want to half-ass it, so we're still going to do all the fun new things that we're going to do, but we're just not doing them. Not just yet. We're going to tread water for a few weeks here as I try to survive. And that's what's happening. So this is, you know, if you tuned in to listen to the Punk News Podcast, you're going to still hear something that approximately sounds like that, this week and next. And then we'll see, maybe we're all just going to quit. Joining me on this, failure of a program is Hallie Bullitt joining us once again from Jersey.
Hello. Oh God, that still sounds weird. Here I am from Jersey.
From Jersey. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I just drank a orange and cream Stewart's soda, and I'm feeling pretty good. Although I hope I don't burp right into my mic.
So do we all. And then also, you heard him earlier. It was John Gentile out in Philadelphia. Hello, John. Officially, hello.
Speaking of Spencer's, I applied for a job at Spencer's when I graduated college in their copywriting job. And I got so close to getting it, but I didn't. Because one dumb thing I thought, they said, can we look at your MySpace? So I said, sure. And it basically said, should I get a job or should I go to law school? And the guy said, oh, so are you going to law school? Or are you looking for a job? I was like, oh, I'm looking for a job. You know, but he didn't believe me. I didn't get the job. So I went to law school. And I always wonder what would have happened if I got that job writing copy for Spencer's.
This is a real sliding doors scenario. Did you miss this reference? Am I referencing this like too like girly, this reference? Sliding doors. The movie is Gwyneth Paltrow. You get to follow like different what her fate would have been if something different had happened in her life. Never mind. Moving on.
Is that a movie?
Yeah.
I'll watch it. Is it good?
I don't know. I've never seen it. I just know the concept because I feel like how do I just know what Gwyneth Paltrow movies? I know what they're about, whether I saw them or not.
I feel like everybody hates Gwyneth Paltrow now, but I'm not sure if that's justified or not.
People love to turn around and hate people that they used to like. I don't understand this. Like, I don't understand that about humans. I don't. They like get glee out of hating things they used to like. It's very strange to me.
That's true. That's true. Especially in music. You see that in music a lot, which on the Punished podcast, we've always rallied against. Adam and I, for years and years, have been staunch defenders of John Lydon. Isn't that right, Adam?
Yeah, we have. We've been staunch defenders of all the stupid things he's done too, like the butter commercials and all that. Like we're all in.
Listen, you can't make fun until you go out and save an ape like habitat. You can't make fun of John Lydon's butter commercial. That's all I'm saying.
I'm with you guys. I'm on Team Lydon.
Good. All right.
So John, on the subject of people irrationally hating things, do we have any mail?
Yes, we do. This is from Jason, who's written a bunch of times over the years. And he says, I bought a Ramones t-shirt at Target. And then he had the emoticon of the person like throwing their hands in the air. And then the emoticon of someone slapping their own face. And I guess Jason's asking, is that cool? Is that lame? And do we approve of people buying Ramones shirts at Target?
I have a perhaps unconventional thought about this. There is, like, in general, I feel like, you know, you should, if you're buying music clothing, try to buy this in a way that most directly is going to assist the artist and all that, and try not to, you know, bootleg things and whatever. But there's something about, like, classic 70s era punk bands that I just don't care. And it's either because everyone's dead and now it's just some mechanism that's merchandising their lives, or just that I assume that they've figured out, you know, a way to make a buck 40 years on and they don't need to worry about me. Because there's a place in, where is it? There's a place in Toronto. It might still be there. I don't know. COVID has shut everything down forever. But there was a place in Toronto that called Black Market that makes, that just does all sorts of just like, screen prints of various t-shirts and stuff like that. And for years, like since I was a teenager, I've gone into there and just bought like random shirts that I'm certain no artist is actually getting paid for. But they've always been stuff that when I was young in particular were like really important for me to have around. Like I went in there and I brought, and like during the ska era, I was able to get like a annoyingly bright orange shirt with like the Specials logo on it that I'm sure was, you know, none of the Specials actually got that money. I went in there and I got I had a really killer Buzzcock shirt at one point from there. I have a bootlegish Ramones shirt from there right now where they went and they took the, they took like a screen cap of Joey when he was animated on The Simpsons and put that on there. And then it says Ramones on top of it. Like I bought lots of stuff from there over the years because it's one of these places where you can go in and like the shirts are dirt cheap and they're going to fall apart anyways. And it's all just like kitschy stuff and bootleg stuff. But yeah, it's, you know, I've never had the moral quandary about like, oh, is the estate of Joey Ramone going to get paid for this shirt? Or for that matter, is Matt Groening and the Simpsons Corporation going to get paid for this shirt? It's just like, I don't know. It's a weird blind spot. It's a total hypocrisy on me because I wouldn't walk into it. I wouldn't walk into some place. And if they were selling like a, I don't know, like a bootleg pup shirt or something like that, I don't feel I would buy that because I'm like, no, that's a band that's out there in the world trying to like, you know, make money and not die. So I don't know. Is that wrong?
But they wouldn't be selling the pup shirt, right? See, that's the whole thing. It's, well, like, sure, if you're a band that's big enough to be having your stuff sold at Target, I'm like not so worried about, I don't know. I'm no longer concerned about whether you're making a living or not if you're big enough to have your stuff sold at Target.
But like, I feel that for some reason, shirt is lower on my hierarchy of authenticity than other things. Like unless it has some amazing story behind it, I would be very reticent about buying something that's clearly a bootleg piece of music, right? Like, which is to say, like, if it's a John's bought a few of these things. Like, if it's a strange Russian pressing of something that is like that is so such an over the top bootleg that it's become like a cultural artifact in and of itself, that's one thing. But if it's just like,
Adam, are you referring to my Stooges record?
I might be. I mean, there's a handful of, I feel like whenever I'm at a record show, I always see like 8 or 10 like Clash records that I've never seen before. And it's always just like some random assortment of songs that has like some Eastern European country stamped on the back of it that you're positive that like no one in any official capacity kind of put that out. But you see one of those things and you're like, you know what? It's sort of just like the weirdness of it almost justifies its existence. But if it was just like a fucking knockoff because someone was trying to make a buck and there's nothing, you know, it hasn't circled back around to being kind of fascinating, I feel like I would not want to support the bootleg music there that's taking the money out of the hands of like the actual people that are making that music. But for shirts, if it's a big band, I don't know. I don't care. I mean, hypocrisy is what the show is all about, though. So that's, I'm fine with that. Go to Target, buy a Ramon shirt, whatever. You're fine. You can be dressed in worse things.
I used to have a Misfits shirt. That was like my favorite shirt. I was like, yeah, Misfits. And I don't mean when I was like 15 either. I mean when I was like 24. I was like, yeah, Misfits. And I love the Misfits. Misfits are one of my all-time favorite bands. But I would feel like a Tool wearing a Misfits shirt now. And maybe I'm wrong for feeling like a Tool. I love the logo. I love the shirt. But everybody's got a Misfits shirt. So like wearing a Misfits shirt is almost like, yeah, I like water. Or, yeah, I like apples. You know what I mean? Like I don't know. I mean, there's the argument is the purpose of a shirt to advertise to other people a band you think they should check out? Or is it a way to signify and differentiate your shirt yourself? And the reality is probably both. And I just don't think I'd wear a Misfits shirt these days. I would feel like – I love the Misfits, but I would feel like a Tool wearing a Misfits shirt. I don't know why. Because everybody's got one. That's why.
I feel that way about like CBGB stuff. Like – there's something where I don't feel that I could bring myself to go put on one of those, even though like I have certainly nothing against like that as a piece of punk history, but clearly I think at this point it's a brand that's been like eaten and digested by who knows who and taken out and, you know, merchandised out to I wanted to say yuppies, but I don't even know what that means anymore. But right, like just like taken and merchandised like out of context to everyone. And yeah, like I feel that like wearing one of those, I would feel self-conscious that I look like a douchebag.
Hallie, do you think it's still safe for me to wear my Michael Graves shirt?
Oh, that old, your old favorite Michael Graves shirt. I mean, you've worn it till it's almost threadbare. Maybe you should just retire it anyway. You know, just you've loved it too much.
You should just have to stick with the face paint. That's all.
Okay. Well said. This is from Sean, and Sean says, have you followed Ancient Artifact? It's Brian from Nightbird's Instagram, where he gets crazy record scores and he sells them. I have no idea where he gets insane score after insane score. I want to start selling records for money and keep some of them as well. You talk about record shopping a lot. How can I buy and sell records that make money and get really hard to get records? From Sean.
John, this is a you question, if there is one. Like, how do you work the
Well, actually, I would say it ain't easy, but it is easy. However, Brian from Nightbirds has an insane Instagram called Ancient Artifacts, where I think he's making a living just flipping like first and second wave punk and hardcore records. And honestly, like, it makes me unhappy sometimes. It's like, man, like, how's he getting those scores? And I make just enough money selling records to buy my records because I've got a problem. So the way I get it is, you know, I just know a fair amount about what records are worth money. So when I go to the record convention, when I go to the flea market, when I go to the record store, I usually, if it's big enough, I can flip through and get ones that I know that I can resell on Discogs and get my money back for whatever else I want to buy, you know, within reason. Sometimes you get crazy scores, but like where I have to depend on making money off records, I don't think I could do it. I'm very jealous of Brian of Nightbirds. I don't even mean that in a complimentary sense. I mean, I'm like envious, and it makes me unhappy to see his Instagram because he gets these insane records. I'm like, where did you like? But on the other hand, you know, he's toured for like 20 years. Like he's recorded with punk legends, so he probably has connections you and I don't have. And so I wish I had the knowledge and I guess maybe the chutzpah. I mean, I'm guessing on some of these scores that he's reselling, he's probably dropping $5,000. I wish I had the chutzpah to drop $5,000 on records from somebody and try to flip them for 10 or whatever. But I've never made that jump because I've always felt it would backfire. My success has always been on buying a CD for $1 in the dollar bin in the CD store. Sometimes it's a $100 rare CD or something like that, you know. I rarely am able to buy an expensive record and sell it for even more. I don't seem to have that knack or that experience or that skill. That being said, Brian buys records that the records that I sell are ones that only 20 people want, but those 20 people really want them. The ones he buys are records that a lot of people have, but even more people want and are willing to spend crazy money for. And so I think the only way to really get those connections is to, like, you know, be as entrenched in music as he has been for the past 20 years, I'm guessing. And also, I think you just got to always be on. I think he makes it like his full time job. So, you know, on the street, you'll see like buy records, you know, or I buy records, or in Craigslist, you see I buy records. I think if you do that all day, every day, you're probably going to hit some good stuff, but you got to make it your full time job, I guess. That being said, if you want to make money, there's better ways to make money than selling records, I think. And that also raises the question of, well, is it cool to buy a record and then sell it for an insane price above what you paid for it? And my perspective is, if you find a used record in the wild, then you can sell it for whatever it's worth because you did the work, you found it, your knowledge got it. What I think is lame is if it's like at a merch table or record store day and you were just lucky enough to be the first in line when everyone else got their 5 hours ahead of time anyway, you buy it and you flip it. Or if it's like a rare record online, where they're like, all right, these are going for sale on Monday at 10 a.m. That's when you can buy one. If you bought that and flip it, I think that would be lame because you're just really being lucky and you're taking that record out of the hands of someone else that earnestly wanted it and didn't want to just make money off of it. But if you find something in the wild, used or whatever, then I think it's fair to flip it and make, you know, the market value off of it because you did the work, you were out there looking, and you had the luck. That's my perspective. But I wouldn't recommend records as a business. And if you do try to buy records and sell them, I say get in and get out in the next 2 years. Because records are actually more expensive now than they've ever been, which blew my mind because I thought the craze would have been over like 3 or 4 years ago. I don't see records being worth nearly what they are now in 10 years. I really don't.
I wonder if Brian's just become like that guy. You know what I mean? Like, I wonder now if he has a reputation as just being a guy that will buy that like really rare stuff. And I wonder if like some of that stuff just kind of comes to him or like people contact him and are like, hey man, are you interested in this thing? But he doesn't run like a booking agency.
He does, right now.
Hmm? Oh, right.
He's touring right now, you know,
But yeah, I wonder how much of it is just like, if everyone knows you're that guy, then maybe sometimes those records just like, someone's trying to sell something and they just contact you as like a shortcut. You're like, hey man, do you want this? Like, how much will you pay for those?
That is very much probably what happens. You build up a certain amount of reputation and then this stuff just starts to flow through. Well, all right, John, we have any other mail or should we move on to
just one last thing? You go to the podcast at punknews.org. This is from Youssef, and Youssef says, where's Punk News Podcast 500? I'm waiting on the edge of my seat from Youssef.
I just updated the feed file, Youssef, which would be 3 weeks ago. So from a time vortex standpoint,
go to hell.
Yeah, Oh, that show exists, man. I'm so curious about if I'd love to know how long they last in that show, John, because they gotta last. There's good stuff at the end.
It's good stuff all the way through. I think people listen to it multiple. I've never listened to a 5-hour podcast all the way through. I usually max out about an hour and a half, but I think people will listen to it in multiple sittings, which I approve.
Yeah. Or take some drugs, stay up all night, don't go to sleep, and just do it all in one shot. That's how Elvis died, you know. Okay, anyone want to play a song before we hop on? No,
I can play a song.
Play a song.
Hit it.
So when we were doing the Chris Gethard show, we had like just the most insane bands come through and play the show, like for the entire time that we were doing it, like years and years of just amazing bands coming through like every week. Like big, you know, we'd have like big bands come on, you know, that Nightbirds played the show, and like Screaming Females play the show, and Jeff Rones and Stock. And this is all back when we were like still just like a public access show. We hadn't even like strived for like bigger or better things, but you know, it was really fun because we'd have a week like that where like some of my heroes would come in, or front, you know, like bands I really loved. And then we'd have all these weeks where it would just really truly be just like underground bands from New York, bands that I didn't know, bands that I hadn't heard of. And I just like discovered so much amazing music over the course of all the years that we were doing that show. And this band, Radical Dads, was a band that played the show that I had never heard of. And I like got their record at the show and like wore it out. And I've just followed them ever since. And they put an album out in April. You know, and I would assume haven't really been able to tour that album at all. So I think their new album is amazing. It's called Paved Mountain. Radical Dads is from New York. It's one of the guys from that like indie rock band, Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, that was like super big in like the mid 2000s. So yeah, it's one of the guys is from Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah. And I think another one of the guys from that band also has like produced all of the like Radical Dads albums. So it's really cool. I think this stuff like kind of lives at the crossroads where like indie and like pop punk kind of meet. It's like, you know, like really, really catchy, like hooky guitars and fast paced, and I don't know. It reminds me of another, like, oh, I'll stop talking about it. It's great. this song that I like. Let's see, what's the one that I like the most? Oh, I really like this song, Don't Want to Go. So the song is Don't Want to Go. It's by Radical Dads' album called Paved Mountain.
was Radical Dads with Don't Want to Go. John, let's talk about some news, some stuff that happened in the general punk news universe this past week. The first thing that we want to bring up here is that there is a new Damned EP that is on the way. The EP is going to be called The Rockfield Files. It's out on October 16th via Search and Destroy and Spine Farm. There's a music video that is online for the single Keep 'Em Alive that you can go check out right now on the internet there. This is the follow-up to the Damned's 11th studio album, which was called Evil Spirits. That one came out in 2018. So there's a Damned single, and you can go check it out. And I mean, I think you should. John, Halley, any thoughts about this song?
I thought the song was cool. I thought it went well within the ambit of Evil Spirits, which was a very good record, not amazing. The Damned have made it clear that they're really more interested in playing goth and psychedelic music than punking it up or doing anything like that, which is cool. I'm glad the Damned are doing what they're doing. They sound good. This EP sounds good. And also, I think it's cool they put on the track from the – they put out a greatest hits album like last year that had one new track, which is, as a fan can be a little annoying to try to collect everything. But it's kudos to them for putting that track on this EP with all other new stuff. I suspect this stuff was recorded during the Evil Spirit sessions, but I could be wrong. And it's cool. I don't think it's going to reinvigorate or radically redefine the band, but I dug it, and I'm glad the Damned are doing what the Damned do, and the Damned are awesome. Hallie, what would you think?
This is like a convergence of like so many things that I love. This is the Damned, right? Writing a song about bees. This song is about bees. Can we talk about how amazing that is?
Yes.
This is like, but I do love, like, I do feel like this is happening more and more. Like some of the Damned Bird stuff that you played, like, I do feel like people are starting, you know, people are starting to write songs about the environment, and I'm like totally about that. I'm totally about it. I thought this song was like pretty good. I thought the video, like, you know, what makes me laugh is like when like older bands make videos, and like, you know, if you looked at the video for New Rose, it's like, all of it is like shots of the band, and like the older the bands get, like the fewer and fewer shots of the actual band like are in the video. So this video has like a lot of cool like drone shots. Also, first music video I think that I've seen is like from the perspective of a bee, right? Isn't that what the drone shots are supposed to be? I think that's supposed to be like,
I think so.
You're seeing from the point of view of the bee. I don't know. I enjoyed this. I didn't know if it was like the greatest song I'd ever heard, but I really enjoyed like the ideas, and I like enjoyed the video, and I was into it.
Do you guys think that the title is a reference to Rockford Files, the wonderful private eye detective show from the 70s? Or do you think a bunch of English blokes wouldn't know about that?
I wondered that too.
It seems like it is, and it's distracting, like to the point where as I read it, I kind of stumbled over it. At least in my brain, I did because I wanted to say the other thing. So yeah, I'm not quite sure what that means. I mean, Rockfield might have some sort of context, so I don't know. But this is a song that
Adam, actually, are you anti Rockford? Adam, are you anti Rockford Files?
No, I'm not anti. I'm anti great something show, that Adam. Sounds very much alike it, and then takes me out of the moment where I'm, you know, should be focusing on the Damned. So this is one of these songs where it seemed inoffensive to me. I hit about the 2.5 minute mark, and then I was trying to do other show prep, and I'm like, come on, I got things to do. And I went and I looked at the YouTube video, and there was like another 2-3 minutes of the song to go. And my initial reaction was, oh God, if they just verse chorus for the next 3 minutes, what I've already heard, I'm not going to be cool with this. But they don't. The end of the song sort of gets like psyche and just goes into this just sort of satisfying psych jam for a while. And I'm super into that. So this is maybe not the most mind-blowing song when it's conventional, but then when it just sort of gets drifts and gets jammy in its latter half, I think it redeems it quite a bit. So I'm pro this song. I like this.
Here's a quick answer. Rockfield Studios, which is where this was likely recorded, is a very historic and famous smaller recording studio in Wales. I think it's Wales. Yes, Wales. The Damned recorded there in the 80s. So did Iggy Pop. So did Ian Gillan, Robert Plant, Skids, Bauhaus, Bad Manners, and bands throughout history have. Joe Strummer recorded there. So did The Stripes. I'm trying to think of some other bands that I might recognize here. A lot of famous ones. I would suspect that it is a parody, not parody, a pun on Rockford Files, because it's Rockfield, unless it's a coincidence, but Rockfield Studios is the studio and it's the album's Rockfield File. It sounds like a pun to me.
There you go. Anyways, though, you should always go check out new
bands. Do you like how I researched that and determined the truth through investigation, just like Jim Rockford from the delightful 70s show, The Rockford Files? Starring Jim Gardner.
And nowadays that show would be called Johnny Google, where you would just search for things and then learn where
no,
they
Angel,
are on the internet.
No, Angel, I can't lend you any money. I had to go fishing with my dad. Oh, Jim, just $20. Angel!
Okay, so anyways, 18 years after the killing of seminal Run DMC DJ Jam Master Jay, two men have been arrested and charged with the crime. Following a grand jury indictment, Seth D. Ducharme, U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York, unsealed a criminal indictment an indictment alleging that Carl Jordan Jr. and Ronald Washington conspired to kill Jam Master Jay and then did kill him in retaliation for a drug dispute. The indictment states that Jam Master Jay was involved in transporting kilogram quantities of cocaine between 1996 and 2002. It continues that in July of 2002, he acquired about 10 kilograms of cocaine. It continues that Washington was supposed to sell and distribute that to users. However, an argument between Washington and another party led Jam Master Jay to cut Washington out of the deal. Thereafter, on October 30th, in 2002, Washington and Jordan entered Jam Master Jay's recording studio with firearms. It is alleged that Jordan then shot Jam Master Jay in the head and an unidentified man in the leg. Washington has previously been convicted of gunpoint robberies. He has not yet entered a plea, at least as of when we published the story. And Jordan has entered a plea of not guilty. So there you go. Jam Master Jay news. John, throwing this to you because, you are our resident, you are the house lawyer. Anything to take note of here?
Not from the legal aspect. From the music aspect, there's actually a lot to unpack here. One of the recurring themes, or I don't know if theme's the right word, but the recurring topics of hip-hop and the black community as a whole is, why don't they thoroughly investigate when there's a murder of black musicians or black people in general, which of course what the Black Lives Matter movement is significantly about. In fact, one of KRS-One's later day hits was called Kill a Rapper, and it was about the murder of Jam Master Jay, Tupac, and Biggie, and the idea is, if you want to get away with, the refrain was, if you want to get away with murder, kill a rapper. And so this was kind of an outstanding issue within, I guess, the hip-hop community as a whole. It's, you know, how come no one solved this murder if there was a witness there? I guess the murder hasn't been solved yet, but it looks like we're well on that way. And so it's good in that I guess two bad guys appear to be brought to justice. It raises the question, why did it take so long when we had a witness? I'm not a cop, so maybe having a witness isn't always, you know, your route to indictment. Like maybe the guy just is not going to talk, or maybe he's dead. I don't know. Or maybe he didn't know who the two guys were. Maybe they just two guys ran in and shot us, but I didn't know who they were. That could be it too. I guess kudos to the police officers. One of the main questions here is, should the police be saluted here for staying on this case for almost 20 years, or should they be chastised for taking so long to solve what could have been solved earlier? I don't know. But of course this is bittersweet because it's like, or I don't know, actually it's not even bittersweet. It's kind of a sad story all around because Jam Master Jay, apparently, not we don't know for sure, but I'm appeared to be involved in really heavy drug dealing, which is very surprising. I mean, it is surprising because Run DMC made a lot of money, and I'm sure they had some bad contracts here and there, but despite that, I mean, I'm sure they made a lot of money. So it's sad that these wealthy musicians or musicians who have made a lot of money are having to do these illegal things to make ends meet or to make money. In a way, you can't – I mean, listen, everyone's ultimately responsible for themselves. I'm a big believer in that. That being said, maybe it is a falling of the music industry that, you know, you use this guy's talent and made a whole lot of money off of him, but you didn't prepare him for life after the big party is over and how to manage his money after that. You know, and like I said, everyone's responsible for themselves. But the music industry does have a long history of this kind of an outcome or this kind of story, if you will, which is sad. So it's not a happy story. I guess it's good the murders get caught, but it's kind of a bummer to see that Jam Master Jay was involved in heavy drug trafficking, and that's what led to his death. So I don't know. But, I mean, I guess it's good it got solved.
There you go. Pally, you got anything to add to this one? Hallie's on mute. Hallie's on mute.
Hallie's on mute. There she is.
That or Hallie somehow involved in this crime, and when we started talking about it, she ran away. All right, well.
Hallie's pleading the fifth. She don't want people to know that she's.
Okay. I'm going to keep rolling. I'm going to keep rolling here because, you know. At one point.
Well, you didn't talk about your Canadian boys yet, Adam.
That's what I mean. I'm going to keep rolling. So, all right. So, yeah. So the Nil, the Dirty Nil are back. They are, they've released the second single from an upcoming record that has now formally been announced. When the first single was released, they didn't say anything one way or another about what this is. So about a month ago, they released a song called Done With Drugs. That was like a big, super poppy sort of power pop anthem, and they have now put out this new song called Doom Boy, and it is pretty ridiculous and over the top in a lot of ways that are actually kind of fun. It's again kind of anchored by the Nil's really characteristic huge hooky power pop aspects. But then there's just this gleeful dose of like thrash metal riffing that they've wrapped this whole song around. And the video that was released alongside Doom Boy, which I encourage you to go watch because it's ridiculous, is the band basically really leaning into these lowbrow metal tropes and this with this late 80s VHS kind of aesthetic to it. They're driving around on goofy little bikes and shooting Roman candles at things, and they destroy a minivan. And it's fun. So both these singles, Done With Drugs from a few weeks ago and Doom Boy Now, are going to be on the band's third record, the follow-up to 2018's Master Volume. And they've announced that record is called Fuck Art. So they haven't really given any particular rationale behind what they're intending to do here from an aesthetic standpoint or anything like that. But I mean, if your record is titled Fuck Art and you're releasing a song that's just full of goofy metal riffing, I assume that you are not, you're not shooting to, you know, win any artistic prizes with what you're doing this time. So there you go. You should go check this out. Oh, Fuck Art, whenever it does come out, is going to be on Dine Alone Records, probably later this year. Now, the one interesting thing, John, that is sort of part of what the band's current narrative is so these guys, actually, and a few members of other bands, all happen to live in a house together in Hamilton, Ontario. And what that has meant is as the universe sort of went into lockdown, which at least in terms of in the Canadian context, and I assume it was the same for you guys, but in the Canadian context in Ontario, we got locked down pretty heavily in like the second week of March, I think. So when all that went into place and, you know, we all had to stay home and we couldn't go out and socialize and like everything was closed. These guys all happened to live in the same house. So they just kept doing what they were doing at a clip that I think other bands haven't had the chance to do. I know a lot of bands have tried to record stuff, you know, by remotely passing files from person to person and doing it over Zoom calls and whatever. And I mean, it's a way to work given the circumstances, right? But I'm sure it sucks. So, but these guys just like, they happened to basically be each other's immediate family for all intents and purposes. So they'd have just kind of just been holed up, you know, recording and not having to worry about clumsy telework setups and social distancing and all this other stuff. They've just been doing stuff in their little rock and roll house. So, So I'm curious to see how much material actually comes out of that. So I don't know. Did you check this out, John? You have any thoughts or?
Halle Bullet, The Dirty Mill. Thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs across the horizon, hands across the water.
Not my thing.
Halle's back.
I don't know.
Where'd you go?
Hi. Sorry. I had a little home emergency I had to deal with. I'm sorry I cut out for a second, but I don't know. This wasn't my thing. I'm back just in time to say that The Dirty Mill was not my thing. Sorry.
John, any thoughts? Are we rolling on here?
The Dirty Mill, I've seen them live. I think they're cool. I'm not dissing them. I dig them. I saw them open for Flag, right? That was The Dirty Mill? Yeah, it was. I think. It was that and the other Adam favorite band. Which band is Topanga? Is that The Dirty Mill?
Topanga is Pop.
No, it was Dirty Mill open for Flag.
That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it was Dirty Mill. Yeah, Dirty Mill, they rock live. They're cool. I'll check it out, and maybe I'll become a big fan. I know Adam's been a defender since day one. Or not a defender, a fan since day one. And Adam's got pretty good taste, so we shall see.
Yeah, it's such a weird band for me to witness, like, having a career now, because they played, like, every local punk show in town for, like, 5 or 6 years around here before they even, like, bothered to release a full length. And I remember even when they did release a full length, it seemed very strange to me, because it was always, like, this was a band that just, like, released, you know, 2 or 3 cool 7-inch singles a year and otherwise didn't get involved in like being like a proper career band, but now they are. And I forget sometimes how long.
You feel as though you've lost a friend, Adam? Does it feel like losing a friend?
No. I'm not going to go so far and say it's like losing a friend.
Did your classmate you used to play Dungeons & Dragons with go away to college and he came back and that was totally different? And doesn't want to play Dungeons & Dragons with you anymore, and you feel as though he's moving on without you? Is that what it feels like, Adam, deep down inside?
Yeah, I mean, deep down, I guess. Deep down, I guess. All right, but now we are going to move on. Okay, on September 11th, MVD is going to be releasing a 3-CD box set of Johnny Thunder's 1985 solo album, Que Sera Sera, dubbed Que Sera Sera Resurrected. Sounds like a Matrix single or something. The set is going to include the album proper, remixed by the Vibrators' Pat Collier, and with Thunder's guitar more present in that mix. The original version, which was actually Thunder's own mix, it's been criticized for how his guitar comes off in it. So there's also 2 unreleased tracks that are going to be that were left off the original album that are going to be included on this one, along with 6 previously unheard outtakes. Then there's going to be a second disc, which will have 18 unheard live tracks that were recorded in Amsterdam, Lyon, and Geneva. And then the third disc will have the original album and single mixes, so you can go kind of compare and contrast and see if they make you angry. And then lastly, the release is going to include a 36-page booklet by Thunder's biographer Nina Antonia. John, what's your thoughts on this story here? I am completely oblivious to this record. So I am just, I'm going to sit back and drink my water here.
Well, listen, the New York Dolls rule. New York Dolls, they get a fair amount of props. They should get more. New York Dolls are amazing. Johnny Thunder's first solo record, excellent record. I'd say not as good as New York Dolls' first record, but excellent record. Johnny Thunder's second record, So Alone, excellent record. I would argue better than the first because there's more variety. Que Sera Sera, the third Johnny Thunder's record, not a great record. And I approve a great deal of this deluxe treatment. You know, it's somewhat annoying. As a fan, I'm annoyed when an amazing record gets reissued and they tweak it and change it. I'm all for good remastering and even a good remixing, but to alter a record is annoying. However, what records should be altered and changed? Ones that weren't so great to begin with. Que Sera Sera is a excellent candidate for the box set treatment. There's not that many box sets these days, and I love box sets. I recently got the Iggy Pop, the Idiot, the Bowie Years box set. Amazing, and as I said before, I was wrong to criticize it for calling it Iggy Pop, the Bowie Years, which I criticized it before, because it really is the Bowie Years. Little did I know, the Idiot is actually a David Bowie record with Iggy Pop singing, which I didn't know. Excellent box set. So I love me a good box set. It's like getting a treasure chest. I miss the era when there was tons of box sets coming out. I'm all about this. And also, like I said, is if we're going to break apart or reconstruct an album, we should do it with ones that were flawed to begin with, but maybe are really good behind them. I can't really think of too many records that were crappy and then were retooled and made amazing records. But maybe this will be the one. I think it's cool that the guy from the Vibrators is doing it because he's a big fan of the band and he lived in England when Johnny Thunders lived in England or France. I think Johnny Thunders actually lived in France. And so he's a good guy. He's a musician. He's a musician, so he's got the technical skill, but he's a fan, so he knows what the fans want to hear. Often, musicians aren't the best judge of their own work. Sometimes they are. A lot of times they aren't. The biggest challenge here is it's no secret, Johnny Thunders had a really bad heroin problem during this time. And so is the sort of crappiness of the original album, is that just because it was mixed bad and because Johnny Thunders was in a haze? And he just didn't piece it together that well? Or is it because, like Johnny Thunder's third, fourth, and fifth album, they're not even really albums. They're kind of just like demos and sessions put together to look like an album, to mark it as an album that makes a quick buck. We'll find out. I'm hoping it comes out cool. If it's reasonably priced, which I think it probably will be because it's on MVD and it's only like three CDs, I'll get it. If it's expensive, I'm not going to get it. But if it's like $30, I'll probably pick it up. I'm definitely interested to hear this. And also, actually, kudos to MVD. If this project works, maybe we'll get more like three CD deluxe box set treatments in the future, which I think is an awesome format.
I think maybe it's cool if it gets people to go back and listen to that record. I think sometimes when records are coming out, like in the moment, especially if you're someone like Johnny Thunders and the bar has been set so high, and like people are just like maybe disappointed that it's not, you know, another New York Dolls record, or they're, you know, maybe he really came out swinging more with the first two solo albums and this one was not as good. I have to say, I'm with Adam. I'm not that familiar with this record, but so maybe I shouldn't be talking about it, but just hypothetically, I think sometimes when things are coming out in the moment, maybe we're like tend to be critical, especially if someone's getting on a little bit further into their career. And I think it'd be nice if this gave people a chance to sort of like go back, listen to it with fresh ears. And like, maybe, you know, I would imagine if someone's doing like a huge box set of this, there's like gotta be some merit there. I also think it's so funny that like, they basically just have to, they want to go back and like remix it and like remaster it because Johnny Thunders himself did such a bad job. There's something really funny about that to me that I'm also like, I'm sort of appreciating that about this project. But you're right, musicians are not always the best judge of like their own work, and that is why it's really healthy to get someone else to mix your record or, you know, as master your record. Sometimes you really just do need fresh ears on a thing.
Agreed. So what are we doing now, John? We play another song. We
yeah,
canceling the podcast.
Yeah, Listen, Adam, we're doubling down. We're throwing more gas on the fire. We're cranking forward, baby. And speaking of person that's cranking forward, Jesse Michael, he's cranking forward with Classics of Love, which we talked about before. We didn't play a Classics of Love track a couple weeks ago, did we?
I don't think so.
Or at least we're playing one now.
Who's going to come?
Classics of Love is back with Jesse Michaels, with Sharif Dumani, and with, I always forget this poor guy's name. I feel so bad. I know it's John something. Peter John Fontes. Classic of Love, of course, was Jesse Michaels' hardcore band that he started in like 2008, I think. They put out a record with the Hard. They put out a couple of singles and an EP and a record with the Hard Girls in 2010, I think, or no, it was 2012, I think it was, and it was so good. And then he just put out a new EP again and as Classics of Love, but with a different lineup. And it was, as we said on the podcast before, it's so freaking good. We're gonna play one of the tracks. You should go on, pay for this and download it and buy the record when it comes out. I think in like fall, reportedly, or not hypothetically, tentatively on Asian Man Records. Jesse Michaels is the man. His music is so freaking great. This is Classics of Love off their new EP, World of Burning Hate.
Love. All right, we got a bunch of reggae to talk about, which is fun. So let's just do this. We got three of them. Can I rifle through the three, and then we'll hunt and pack about which aspects we want to talk about? Does that work for you?
By all means.
I don't want to fuck up your shit, John. If you got you have a very specific plan in mind.
Listen, Adam, I'm just down to talk about reggae anytime. Anytime.
All right. So we got three that we want to talk about here. So first of all, Lee Scratch Perry, reggae icon, person we should not even have to introduce. So he's done all kinds of crazy collaborations over the years with various musicians. So he recently took part in an album by a Russian reggae band whose name I cannot read in Cyrillic, but it translates to aquarium or Aquarius. Cyrillic, the right word? Or is that like...
I think the language is Russian. I think it's the Russian language, yeah, in the Cyrillic alphabet.
Whatever. I can't read it one way or the other. Anyways, the band's name translates to aquarium or Aquarius or something like that. So they have a new album out. It is called, whatever their name is, In Dub. And you can check out a video that basically is, I assume, is it the whole record? It's like a 30-minute track, if not.
It's a mind, whatever it is.
Yeah, so you can go find it on YouTube right now. And Scratch is in there. He clicks in at about the 7.5-minute mark. And there's this trippy, crazy animated video that plays along with it. So that is item one. Item two, Hepcat. One of the, I mean, I'm, I'll go out and say this as the official arbiter of third wave ska, but like as one of the best bands to have come out of the whole third wave ska era. So they're back with a kind of rare new song. It's their first material in about 10 years. It's a song called One. There is a kind of delightful, you know, everybody in isolation recording over Zoom style video for the song that is online now that you can check out. Hapcat, of course, kind of like came to prominence in the punk scene as being one of the Hellcat Records ska bands back in the era where, you know, the Slackers were also, you know, emerging at the same time. So yeah, Hapcat rules. That's there. Finally, Mighty Diamonds, reggae legends. They have a new track out. It is called Nuttinagwan, and you can find the standalone single streaming on YouTube, or you can find it on punknews.org right now. So, John, we got Mighty Diamonds, we got Hepcat, we got Scratch. How do you want to attack this?
It's all good, man. It is all good. First of all, let's hit up Lee Scratch Perry. Perry is the man. The dude is literally 84. Before COVID hit, he was literally touring and recording. He's a wacky guy, and that's who Lee is. And there's something to be said for someone like Ian MacKaye, who is very precious about his work and doesn't want his work presented in any context except for one that he personally can vouch for and thinks is good. And there's something to be said for the Mighty Upsetter, who was just down to do whatever and throw it at the wall and see what sticks. And to that end, you've got a iconic Jamaican musician with dudes in Russia that are playing music influenced by Jamaica, which is crazy enough to think of. And this, what I thought was most hilarious about this video is it was made by Russians, but it's like Russians using, I guess, stereotypical North American tropes about Russia in the video. And so I don't know if they're making fun of the tropes or if those tropes are accurate. There's like the one guy doing like the knee dance, like where you squat and kick your legs out. And I just thought it was cool. I don't know if I would, if I saw this record for $10, I would buy it, but I wouldn't spend more than that. But I thought it was cool and amusing. And I just think Perry is the coolest. Hepcat, I thought the Hepcat track was not only good, surprisingly good, like very, very good. Like they sound so good. They sound smooth. And I'm not necessarily a fan of easygoing ska, but I like Hepcat and I like this track. It goes to show that with regard to punk, I usually argue to say that skill doesn't matter and being perfect doesn't matter. Raw craziness is what matters. This track firmly makes the argument that skill and soul matters a lot. Lastly, very similarly, Mighty Diamond. This track is not radically reinventing reggae, but it's an excellent track. If you don't know who the Mighty Diamonds are, Mighty Diamonds are one of the most famous reggae vocal trios. They started in the mid-60s in Jamaica. Their iconic record is called Right Time, which is considered a massively important roots reggae record. And they're kind of along the lines of like the Wailing Souls in that they started out as strictly roots, but then kind of like merged into rockers reggae and even dancehall to a degree in the 80s. What I thought was amazing about this track is it's got the three original Mighty Diamonds, and they like Danzig is the man. I will not say a bad thing about Danzig. He's the man. But unfortunately, from years of screaming and growling, his voice is somewhat blown out. Dave Vanian, to Dave Vanian's credit, Dave Vanian still sounds fantastic. And I would wager that's when you go see Dave Vanian live, he doesn't totally blast his voice out. He focuses on the croon, not the rage, which, you know, I would like to hear him go crazy. But on the other hand, if this is what it takes to preserve his voice, I appreciate it. Punk singers and singers in general, you know, Bob Dylan's the man. His voice is much different than it used to be. You know, Mick Jagger still sounds really, really good, I think, but he sounds a lot different than he did in the 60s and 70s. Astoundingly, the Mighty Diamonds, who have been singing for 50 years, sound like they did in 1970. Like, it's crazy how amazing their voices sound. And I don't know if that's like how you might be able to speak to this. I don't know if it's just luck, if it's talent, or have they taken measures to preserve the voice to make sure their voice sounds good. I thought this track was really, 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 really good. And I thought they sounded so amazing, and it lifted my soul. Just like the spirit of the voice of the Mighty Diamonds. Hallie, what do you think about their voice? I'm curious. Do you have a perspective or inside info?
I don't. I mean, I don't. But my guess is that, like, right when you're when you're getting older and you're a singer, there are like, right, two things that could happen that are going to really fuck your shit up. Sorry to say, but like, one is just like taking big long breaks from singing, which lots of people do. They get in, they get, you know, maybe where they're not at the height of their career, and maybe they're not as touring as often, but like the voice is really like, you just have to keep singing. It is like a use it or lose it kind of thing. So my guess is that these guys just kind of have never stopped singing. But also you can't take that to the extreme. It's like, you can't just be like screaming and actually like abusing your voice for like decades and decades and not expect to like actually have damaged it. So I my guess as a singer is that these guys have done just the right amount of like healthy singing for probably their entire lives. That's why they still sound so good.
Well
just
said.
A little guess. I loved that. The Hepcat song was probably my favorite of all of this stuff. And it was interesting to me. I mean, I don't know what you guys think, but like, I think back when, you know, they were releasing stuff, like, I think they were considered like, maybe like one of the more soulful of that like third wave ska stuff. And to me, that's actually like what has made like their old stuff age so well, is that like, it really is just like, it's kind of, to me, kind of timeless. I don't listen to it and I'm like, oh God, this is so like, you know, this reminds me of when I was in college or something. You know what I mean? There's just something really timeless about their stuff. And like, I thought this song kind of stuck with that too. And I really liked the instrumentation. It was like violin on it. I thought it was like, when it started, I was like, okay, a ska song. And then actually I thought it just like got more and more interesting as I listened. I really liked that track.
Hepcat has always seemed to be like the most dignified of, of any of the bands in that era, but not in a way that is boring. Cause like you could wear dignified, you know, in a sense of you being maybe too much of a traditionalist where then you're adhering too much to the form. You're kind of stamping out some of the spontaneity, but I never got that impression. Just Hepcat seemed to just have it together. And there was such a contrast between Hepcat just being smooth and cool, and then all of these like skittering maniacs that were around them playing third wave stuff. Like, you think back to the Given the Boot compilations where you'd have like, you know, Hepcat songs and then like Choking Victim songs on the same mix. And ostensibly those are in the same genre, or at least in the same weird little cultural movement that we were in at the time. But like, holy shit, like there's such a difference in where you can spin that genre one way or the other. And yeah, I have the same impression as you. Like, if you can go and put on one of those Hepcat records these days, and it nothing about it screams like 1998 at you. Like, it just sounds good. Just, it sounds like it aged well, but it also, it was never in step with the trend. It did like it they could have written that, they could have wrote those records like, you know, 10 years in either direction and it wouldn't have mattered. Hepcat is a great band. John, there's some stories coming up from about Suck at Germany. I don't know anything about this, so why don't you feel this one?
Suck is rad. They're a band out of Germany, and there's four of them now. I think there should be three. And they just put out a video session where they played about a half set's worth of tracks and had some short interludes. And I don't necessarily have a whole lot to add, except for, like, if you want modern kick-ass punk rock, Suck is kicking ass. And I dug this track. I dug the studio video called Give Me Your Number. I think it's funny, but it's dangerous and it's cool. This band rocks.
I thought like this video was like a great example of like something creative you could do in lockdown. Although they're not necessarily socially distanced from one another, so I hope they're all healthy. But I thought it was like a really like an interesting way to like stay creative and keep putting your music out there and give fans like a little extra, I don't know, sort of like an intimate glimpse into the band. I liked the really clear sort of hard hitting statement they made about Burger at the beginning of the video, which I do feel like they kind of, you know, they have a big growlers. They have a big poster for the growlers in the background of the video. And the growlers were like one of the Burger bands that was like really like brought up in everything that just happened. So I thought it was like good that they kind of made this like really clear statement at the beginning. Now I don't want to get too PC, but John, can you explain to me what's up with the frog stuff? Because the frog stuff like kind of creeped me out. Do you know what I'm getting at?
You mean in the studio session or in the music video?
Okay, so in the studio, is it the studio? Oh, maybe it was the music video. Maybe I watched both. There's one where they like all show that they have a tattoo that says frog. And then right, they have that EP that's called Frog. And the EP, the illustration on the front, to me, like, definitely looks like a Pepe the Frog kind of thing going on. Oh. Plus they're from Germany. Plus three of them have their heads shaved. So I was a little bit like, I got myself a little freaked out.
You think this band might be sketch?
I don't think they are, because I think it would be really funny for like a band of like Nazi white supremacists to then put out a super like PC statement about Burger Records at the beginning of their video. But I did sort of feel like maybe it's just a little tone deaf. Like it's a little tone deaf. Like I'm pretty sure like Pepe the Frog was actually like officially declared to be like a meme version of like hate speech. Like, so I don't know. Something about it. I was like, you're German, you're skinheads, and like you have all this frog imagery, and I'm getting freaked out. And I think you should be smarter about maybe like what you're putting out in the world. But I don't know. Maybe that was just me.
Is he pop? Like, do people know what he is in Germany though, or is he like a North American thing? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess so. But I don't. It feels like they're putting. You're right. Maybe it's just because they're not. But maybe that's a very American phenomenon. In fact, you know what? Actually, now that you say it, I think Pepe the Frog. That's funny. That made me remember when in Asia they like started using Pepe the Frog as like a pro-democracy thing with like all the Hong Kong stuff, but I don't know. There was something about this that struck me as strange. But back to the video, this in studio video that they made, I thought was really creative and really interesting.
Well, I guess time will tell if Stuck are all right or if they're just like frogs. You know?
Am I the only? Seriously though, am I the only one that got freaked out by that?
Honestly, I'm not trying to be a dick. It didn't cross. I didn't think anything of the frog, really. I mean, I just thought it's a frog. Okay. You know what I mean? Like, but I mean, I'm not saying you were definitely wrong. I'm saying what you're saying is a possibility. I didn't get those vibes, but I could not conclusively say it's not a sketch frog. You know.
But I love.
I like frogs in general, though.
I know. And you know what, actually, if you're probably right. They probably just like don't know that frogs have like a bad connotation in America. And in that way, I'm very jealous of them because I want frogs back, man. Like I want to be able to like frogs again. I don't want to have to like, I want frogs back. I wish I didn't know that frogs were bad now. So anyhow, good for them and their frogs. Now I've done a 180 reversal on this.
What do you think Kermit thinks of Pepe the Frog, man?
So pissed.
It's not easy.
So pissed. He wants to run Pepe over with his bicycle. He's pissed. Well, Kermit.
Even Pepe didn't want to be Pepe. You know, Pepe. No. Pepe stole. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Poor Pepe. And the internet is so weird, Hallie. The internet is so weird.
It is. And it's like, and it also like it moves so quickly that it's like, you just have all this like bizarre shit, like flying at you all the time and you're trying to sort it all out.
Well, speaking of bizarre shit that's flying at you all the time that you're trying to sort out, Henry Rollins has an online show that he's launched with his co-host Heidi May. It is called the Henry and Heidi $1.99 show. It's self-produced. If the title does not hint to you what it is served from a internet service by which you can pay money to watch videos of things, and I would guess that it's $1.99. So he states the show is going to be similar to his podcast and will also include visuals, of course. The podcast is focused on Rollins telling different stories from his past, and it's likely that the new show is going to have a similar format. So you can find a link to this thing on Henry Rollins' website, and I have not parted with $1.99, so I'm not sure what this sucker looks like. John, have you partaken in the Henry Rollins $1.99 show?
I have not. I do approve of the price point. As we discussed a number of episodes ago, some bands are doing like $10 online shows, which, I mean, honestly, like, I don't know if I'm being hypocritical or not. Maybe once or twice I would do it, but I cannot see myself regularly paying $10 to watch a concert online. Hypocritically, if I was at a show and they had a DVD for $10, like a live DVD, I'd be like, hell yeah, give it to me right now. So I don't know if that makes any sense or not. However, $1.99, it's a little bit easier to part with $1.99 than $10. So I approve of the price point. As always, I've got very mixed feelings about Henry. He's a great storyteller. He's got awesome stories to tell. But I can't get over the fact that he dissed Flag and Keith Morris. You know, it's like, He was dissing Flag for being a band and playing, quote, old songs out on the road. But then he's making money telling old stories. So what's the difference? I think, if anything, I think Flag is more admirable. But that's just my beef with Henry. I swing back and forth on Henry weekly. Some days I'm like, you know, Henry's not so bad. He does some cool stuff. And sometimes I'm like, how dare he speak bad about Keith? Don't you ever speak bad about Keith, you know? So he's a good storyteller. I definitely enjoy his podcast a lot, but I'm frustrated by him often.
Do you think you're going to have to accept that people that were so close to the calamitous center of Black Flag are never going to be able to step back and appreciate what it was with the same reverence that you have as a fan? Like,
no, and here's why.
Like these guys are they're all going to hate each other for some reason or another, on and off. And like, I don't know if you should hold it against them that they're going to beef about things that, you know, are only going to be reflective of their personal experience, but like aren't actually going to be objective.
I can appreciate that stance, but I think it's an inaccurate stance, and here's why. I feel like Henry says things that sound cool and sound like he means something, but he doesn't really mean it. And not to beat too much up on Henry, but, you know, when long before the whole Flag thing on Facebook, when Black Flag had a Facebook and Keith Morris ran it, long before the whole reunion thing and everything, people would go on and say, Henry sucks, Keith was really Black Flag. And Keith would go on and say, no, Henry's cool, Henry's my friend, he's an important and great part of Black Flag. And Keith defended him for years. And then when Henry decided to raise money for the West Memphis 3, which was a great thing for him to do, and went out on the road doing Black Flag songs, he asked Keith to come out and open for him, which was super cool. And Keith did it, and that was cool, you know. But then when Keith decides to tour as Flag or Black Flag with the other guys, all of a sudden Henry's like, oh, you're reliving in the past, you know. He's like, I'm not interested in looking backwards. I don't even want to look forwards. I'm not interested in being a 45-year-old band singing, you know, 18-year-old songs by 18-year-olds. But you literally did that 8 years ago, you know, and you asked Keith to do it, and he helped you out and did it. And so I feel as though Henry is not someone that you can count on, and I feel as though what he says, he doesn't necessarily – I mean, you know, Henry's big thing – one of his big things is, you know, I treat people with respect, blah, blah, blah. But he's best friends with William Shatner, who's a creep. You know what I mean? So what he says doesn't seem to jive up with his actions. So if he was just a dick to Keith because they were all involved in the Black Flag debacle, I could understand it. I think Keith and Chuck Dukowski don't really get along. I can understand that. They were in Black Flag, and Black Flag was an extremely dysfunctional band. But for Henry to continually bag on Flag, which has got nothing to do with Greg Ginn, when he could easily just say, oh, I haven't seen it, or he could just say, you know, they're doing their thing, I'm not going to comment on it, and instead took that opportunity to attack Flag and attack Keith, after Keith not only stuck up for Henry online for years, but went on tour for a project that he wanted to promote, playing the same exact songs, it really changed my perspective of Henry. And people are complex. Henry's a complex guy, but I feel as though the image that Henry projects isn't a real person, and I find that frustrating because his big thing is authenticity, and I don't feel as though he's being authentic. Whereas if it was, you know, if it's Kiss, we know Kiss is being phony. Who, you know, even David Lee Roth. David Lee Roth isn't really the guy on stage, but he's not saying I'm the real thing. I'm, you know, he's saying, "Ooh, I'm David Lee Roth." So as a, and you know, and I'm extremely biased because I think Keith is like the man. I think Keith is the greatest. So if you attack Keith, you're kind of attacking things that I like, and that kind of makes me attack you. And that's why I have very mixed feelings with Henry. He's very talented. He's a great storyteller, but I feel as though he's significantly hypocritical. And that's not the worst thing in the world. He's not out there robbing people. He's not out there, you know, saying bad words. But as a person, I think he's a little wishy-washy.
There you go. Hallie, do you have any perspective on the $1.99 show or John's
No, I say
incredibly
here,
complex
I mean,
feelings.
I say here to John's feelings. I thought those were that was accurate observations about our friend and enemy Henry Rollins. I don't have anything super observant to say about it. I saw Rollins live just sort of because he happened to be performing live at a festival I was at, like not that long ago. And I was actually really pleasantly surprised at how great I thought he was, like legitimately telling such funny stories. Although John, like you're saying, those are some old stories he was telling. That was like stories about like back in the day. And I don't see him or follow him enough to know if he's like told those exact stories on stage a lot before, but they're certainly, he's definitely like reliving his youth. So I don't think he should be pointing the finger at anybody about that. But I don't know. I think he still sort of can really, when he's at his best, I think he's still delightfully entertaining. So I could see this being worth checking out.
Well, there you go. So you can check it out. HenryRollins.com is where you can find a link to where that is, if you want to check it out there. All right, I guess I'll play a piece of music and then we will wrap things up. John, feel good crowd pleaser or something loud and offensive?
Let's go with, you know, I love offensive music. I love nasty music. But right now the world is offensive. And I don't want to put offensive music aside forever because I love it and it's important. But I would say right now, well, Adam, which is the more that encourages critical thinking and doing the right thing? Play that song.
I don't know if either of these.
All right, feel good crowd. Feel good crowd. Let's go.
I not judge them on what type of moral lesson they are trying to teach people. So, all right. So there was a band on It's Alive Records out back in 2016 called Weekend Dads. They were from Halifax. People liked them. And then they haven't released a whole ton of stuff since then, but they got back together in, I'm not exactly sure, it would have been probably early last year, and started recording some stuff, and then it all got fucked up because of the coronavirus, because the band wants the tour behind it. So they have trickled out a single song that a lot of people seem to be very happy about. So Weekend Dads, just to recap a lineup here, it's Corey O'Neill, who used to play in a Ramones core band called the Varsity Weirdos. And he's on guitar and vocals. Bassist James Robinson was from a Halifax pop punk band called the Hemingways. And then the guitarist is Maddie Grace, and she plays in Future Girls and Modern Cynics, and she's had like five or six different bands over the course of the isolation that she's released various stuff with. And then the band brought in Chris Murdoch, who was the singer of Word on the Street, which is a hardcore band that I played on the podcast a while ago. So Chris has stepped in to be their drummer. So it's a bunch of people with a bunch of roots in various Haligonian pop punk bands and punk bands. And they came together to play this, just this fun little melodic punk song that is called Good Hangs. So here you go. This is Weekend Dads, and the song is called Good Hangs. And it's going to be on a full length at some point when the world starts again.
The
this has maybe been the Punk News Podcast. It is very hard to say what anything is anymore. We'll be back next week. If you want to send us email, you can send it to podcast@punknews.org. And any parting thoughts, Hallie, John?
I'm really into the amount of reggae and ska we talked about on this episode, because I do feel that that might be just actually just the perfect soothing, chill out music that we should all be listening to in these trying times. Like, I've been on a ska and reggae kick, but that's my parting thoughts. More ska and reggae, people. Chill out.